Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the supposedly private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. Last week, I was talking about short sales in the context of stock. When short sellers sell stock they don't own, they don't actually get the permission of the real owners. Now, this short sale convention is happening a lot with stock. In the stock market, prices fluctuate from moment to moment according to the number of shares for sale. When millions of shares are sold without ever leaving the possession of the real owners, these virtual sales can force down the price, even when there has been no change in the underlying asset to justify the drop. This can and often does happen when the news about the stock is good, because speculators want to take down the price so they can buy in cheaply. We talk about free market, but in this kind of context, the price is not responding to free market forces. It is responding to speculators with the collusive battering power to overwhelm the market with sell orders, orders in short sales that are actually phony because the sellers don't own the stock. Like what we talked about in the past, fractional reserve lending, in which the same reserves are lent many times over. Short selling has been called a fraud, one that damages the real shareholders and the company. One analyst, David Knight, explains it like this. Quote, short selling is a form of counterfeiting. As a footnote, a counterfeit is to make a copy of, usually with the intent to defraud, to carry on a deception. Now back to the quote. When a company is founded, a certain number of shares are created. The entire value of that company is represented by that fixed number of shares. When an investor buys some of those shares and leaves them registered in his broker's street name, his broker makes those same shares available for someone else to sell short. Once sold short, there are two investors owning the same shares of stock. The price of stock shares are set by market forces, that is, supply and demand. When there is a fixed supply of something, the price adjusts until demand is met. But when supply is not fixed, as when something is counterfeited, supply will exceed demand, and of course, the prices will fall. Price will continue to fall as long as supply continues to expand beyond demand. Furthermore, price decline is not a linear function of supply expansion. At some point, if supply continues to expand beyond the demand, the bottom will fall out of the market and prices will plunge. End of quote. The lending of these shares by a broker who holds them in trust for his customers is comparable to the goldsmith's lending of gold held in trust for his depositors that we talked about in detail in several past shows. The broker's customers may have agreed to lend out their shares in the fine print of their brokerage contracts, but they are probably not aware of it. They could avoid having their shares lent out by taking physical possession of the stock, but if they leave the stock with the broker, as nearly everyone does, it is in street name and can be lent out and sold without the real owner's knowledge, although they still believe in the company and have no intention of flooding the market with their shares. Their goal, of course, is profit, and this is a very good way, a slick way, to make money. An April 2006 article in Bloomberg Markets highlighted another serious problem with short selling. The short seller is actually allowed to vote the shares at stockholder meetings. So this takes us to another level of controlling and influencing companies that really has nothing to do with the value of the product. In this circumstance, to avoid having to reveal what is going on, stockbrokers send proxies to the real owners as well, but that means there are duplicate proxies floating around for the vote. Just as bankers get away with lending the same money over and over because they know most people won't come to collect the cash, brokers know that many shareholders won't go to the trouble of voting their shares. And when too many proxies do come in for a particular vote, the totals are just reduced proportionately to fit. But that means the real votes of real stock owners may be thrown out. Hedge funds are suspected of engaging in short selling just to vote on particular issues in which they are interested, such as hostile corporate takeovers. Since many shareholders don't send in their proxies, interested short sellers can swing the vote in a direction that is not in the best interest of those with a real stake in the corporation. Some of the damage caused by short selling was blunted by the Securities Act of 1933, which imposed an uptick rule and forbade naked short selling, which I'll talk about in a minute. The uptick rule required a stock's price to be higher than its previous sale price before a short sale could be made, preventing a cascade of short sales when stocks were going down. But hedge funds managed to avoid the rule by trading offshore where they were unregulated, which I will discuss in a future show. However, in July 2007, the uptick rule was repealed. Naked short selling is the practice of selling stocks short without ever owning or borrowing them. Like many of the regulations put in place during Roosevelt's New Deal, that rule too has been seriously eroded. And I'll get back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's talk about the naked short sale. According to a November 2005 article in Time magazine, quote, naked short selling is illegal, barring certain exceptions for brokers trying to maintain an orderly market. In naked short selling, you execute the sale without borrowing the stock. The SEC noted in a report last year the pervasiveness of the practice. When not caught, this kind of selling has no limits and allows the seller to drive down a stock. End of quote. But again, we see how the investment arena for the ordinary person is completely unrelated to the value of the products beyond the market machinations. A May 2004 Dow Jones report confirmed that naked short selling is a manipulative practice that can drive a company's stock price sharply lower. The exception has turned the rule into a sham is a July 2005 SEC ruling allowing the practice by market makers. A market maker is a bank or brokerage that stands ready to buy and sell a particular stock on a continuous basis at a publicly quoted price. The catch is that the market makers are the brokers who actually do most of the buying and selling of the stock today. 95% of short sales are now done by broker-dealers and market makers. And market making is one of the lucrative pursuits of those 10 giant U.S. banks called money center banks, which currently hold almost half the country's total banking assets, which we will talk about in a future show. A story run on Financial Wire in March 2005 underscored the pervasiveness and perniciousness of naked short selling. A man named Robert Simpson purchased all the outstanding stock of a small company called Global Links Corporation, totaling over 1 million shares. He put all of this stock in his sock drawer, then watched as 60 million of the company's shares traded hands over the next 2 days. Every outstanding share changed hands nearly 60 times in those 2 days, although they were safely tucked away in his sock drawer. This incident substantiated allegations that a staggering number of phantom shares are being traded around by brokers in naked short sales. Short sellers are expected to cover by buying back the stock and returning it to the pool, but Simpson's 60 million shares were obviously never bought back since they were never available for purchase. And the same thing is believed to be going on throughout the market today in all areas. The role of market makers is supposedly to provide liquidity to the markets, match buyers with sellers, and ensure that there will always be someone to supply stock to buyers or to take stock off sellers' hands. The exception allowing them to engage in naked short selling is justified as being necessary to allow buyers and sellers to execute their orders without having to wait for real counterparties to show up. But if you want potatoes or shoes and your local store runs out, you have to wait for delivery. Why is stock investment different? It has been argued that a highly liquid stock market is essential to ensure corporate funding and growth. That might be a good argument if the money actually went to the company, but that is not where it goes. The issuing company gets the money only when the stock is sold at an initial public offering, as an IPO. The stock exchange is a secondary market. Investors buying from other stockholders hoping they can sell the stock for more and then they pay for it. Basically, it's gambling. Corporations have an easier time raising money through new IPOs if the buyers know they can turn around and sell their stock quickly. But in today's computerized global markets, real buyers should show up quickly enough without letting brokers sell stock they don't actually have to sell. And more fundamentally, if they are investing in products that they find beneficial and believe in. Short selling is sometimes justified as being necessary to keep a brake on the irrational exuberance that might otherwise drive popular stocks into dangerous bubbles. But if that were a necessary feature of functioning markets, short selling would also be rampant in the markets for cars, television sets, and computers, which it obviously is not. The reason it isn't is that these goods can't be hypothecated or duplicated on a computer screen the way stock shares can. Like fractional reserve lending, short selling is made possible because the brokers are not dealing with physical things, but are simply moving numbers around on a computer screen. Any alleged advantages to a company from the liquidity afforded by short selling are offset by the serious harm this sleight of hand can do to companies targeted for takedown in bear raids. The destruction that naked short selling can do was exposed in a July 2004 Investors Business Daily article called Stockgate, which detailed a growing scandal involving market makers and their clearing agency, the Depository Trust Company, DTC. The DTC is responsible for holding securities and for arranging for the receipt, delivery, and monetary settlement of securities transactions. The DTC is an arm of the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation, the DTCC, a private conglomerate owned collectively by broker-dealers and banks. The lawsuit called Stockgate alleged a coordinated effort by hedge funds, broker deals, and market makers to strip small and medium-sized public companies of their value. In comments before the Securities Exchange Commission, C. Austin Burrell, a litigation consultant for the plaintiffs, maintained that illegal naked short selling has stripped hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars from American investors. Over the six-year period before 2004, he said the practice resulted in over 7,000 public companies being shorted out of existence. Burrell maintained that as much as $1 trillion to $3 trillion may have been lost to naked short selling, and that more than 1,200 hedge fund and offshore accounts have been involved in the scandal. The DTC's role is supposed to be to bring efficiency to the securities industry by retaining custody of some 2 million securities issues, effectively dematerializing most of them so they can exist only as electronic files rather than as countless pieces of paper. Once dematerialized, the shares can be rehypothecated, something the Stockgate plaintiffs say is just a fancy term for counterfeiting. They allege that the DTCC has an enormous pecuniary interest in the short selling scheme because it gets a fee each time a journal entry is made in the stock borrow program. According to the court filings, almost $1 billion annually are received by the DTCC for its stock borrow program, in which the DTCC lends out many multiples of the actual certificates outstanding in stock. Worse, the SEC itself reportedly has a stake in the deal, since it receives a transaction fee for each transaction facilitated by these loans of non-existent certificates. And I'll continue in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to the SEC. The SEC was instituted during the Great Depression specifically to prevent this kind of corrupt practice. The Investor's Business Daily article observed, quote, "The largely unregulated DTC has become something of a de facto czar presiding over the entire U.S. markets system. And as the SEC's July 28th ruling indicates, its monopoly over the electronic trading system appears even to be protected. The Depository Trust and Clearing Corp's two preferred shareholders are the New York Stock Exchange and the NASD, a regulatory agency that owns the NASDAQ and the embattled American Stock Exchange. In an era when corporate governance is the primary interest for the SEC and state regulators, the DTCC is hardly a role model. Its 21 directors represent a virtual litany of conflict. The scandal has embroiled hundreds of companies and dozens of brokers and market makers in a web of international intrigue, manipulative short selling, and cross-border actions and denials. End quote. A web of international intrigue and coordinated manipulation. The image recalls the spider webbing described by Hans Schicht. The Stockgate plaintiffs expect to show that the hypothecation or counterfeiting of unregistered shares is a specific violation of the Securities Act of 1933, barring the sale of unregistered securities. Restrictions on short selling were put into the Securities Acts of 1933 and 1934, according to Burrell, because of first-hand evidence that the sheer scale of the crashes after 1929 was a direct result of intentional manipulation of U.S. markets through abusive short selling. Burrell continues, quote, "There are numerous cases of a single share being lent 10 or many more times, giving rise to the complaint that the DTCC has been electronically counterfeiting, just as was done via printed certificates before the crash. Shares could be electronically created, counterfeited, kited, without a registration statement being filed, and without the underlying company having any knowledge such shares are being sold or even in existence." End quote. In a website devoted to the Stockgate scandal called The Falking Truth, Mark Falk wrote in April 2006 that the lawsuits and repeated calls for investigation and reform have made little headway and have been denied media attention. The SEC has imposed only minor penalties for infractions, which are perceived by the defendants as being merely a cost of doing business. Like with antitrust regulation in the Gilded Age, the fox has evidently gotten inside the SEC henhouse. The big money cartels the agency was designed to control are now pulling its strings. Patrick Byrne is president of a company called Overstock.com, which has been an apparent target of naked short selling. In a revealing presentation called The Dark Side of the Looking Glass, the Corporation of Our Capital Markets, he says the SEC has the data on how much naked short selling is going on, but it refuses to reveal the numbers, the players, or the plays. Why? The information can hardly be called a matter of national security. The SEC calls it proprietary information that would reveal the short seller's trade strategies if exposed. Byrne translates this to mean that if the thieves were found out, they could not keep stealing. Why are the regulators protecting them? He offers two theories. Either they are looking forward to being thieves themselves when they go back into private practice, or they are afraid that if they blow the whistle, the whole economy will come crashing down along with the banks that are arranging the deals. Short selling is the modern version of the counterfeiting scheme used to bring down the Continental in the 1770s. When a currency is sold short, its value is diluted just as it would be if the market were flooded with paper currency. The short sale is the basis of many of those sophisticated trades called derivatives, which have become weapons for destroying competitors' businesses by parasitic mergers and takeovers. Billionaire investor Warren Buffett calls derivatives financial weapons of mass destruction. The term fits not only because these speculative bets are very risky for investors, but because big institutional investors can use them to manipulate markets, cause massive currency devaluations, and force small, vulnerable countries to do their bidding. Derivatives have been used to destroy the value of the national currencies of competitor countries, allowing national assets to be picked up at fire sale prices, just as the assets of the American public were snatched up by wealthy insiders after the crash of 1929. Defenders of free markets blame the targeted third world countries for being unable to manage their economies when the fault actually lies in a monetary scheme that opens their currencies to manipulation by foreign speculators who have access to a flood of phantom money borrowed into existence from foreign banks. Just as a footnote too, the term third world is now an anachronism since there is no longer a second world, which was the Soviet bloc. But the term is used because it has a popularly understood meaning and is still widely used, and because the alternatives developing world and underdeveloped world may be misleading. Citizens of ancient third world civilizations tend to consider their cultures more developed than some in the first world. Well, now we have to clarify a lot of this. We need to take another short detour into the shady world of finance capitalism to try to shed some light on the obscure topic of derivatives and hedge funds that largely trade in these worlds. And the hedge funds and derivatives were the horse of a different color in the parallel story of The Wizard of Oz. From The Wizard of Oz, what kind of horse is that? I have never seen a horse like that before. He's a horse of a different color you've heard tell about. That was from The Guardian of the Gate to Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. Well, just as a painted horse is still a horse, so derivatives and the hedge funds that specialize in them have been called merely a disguise, something designed to look different enough from the last time so no one realizes what is happening. John Train, writing in the Financial Times, used this colorful analogy. Quote, "It is like the floor show in a seedy nightclub. A sequence of girls trot on the scene, first a collection of Apaches, then some ballerinas, then cowgirls, and so forth. After a while, does the bemused spectator realize that, in all cases, they were the same girls in slightly different costumes? The so-called hedge fund actually was an excuse for a margin account." End of quote. Hedge funds are private funds that pool the assets of wealthy investors with the aim of making absolute returns, making a profit whether the market goes up or down. To maximize their profits, they typically use credit borrowed against the fund's assets to leverage their investments. Leverage is the use of borrowed funds to increase purchasing power. The greater the leverage, the greater the possible gain or loss. In futures trading, this leverage is called the margin. Leveraging on margin, or by borrowing money, allows investors to place many more bets than if they had paid the full price. In the 1920s, wealthy investors engaged in pooling, combining their assets to influence the markets for their collective benefit. Like trusts and monopolies, pooling was considered to be a form of collusive interference with the normal market forces of supply and demand. Hedge funds are the modern-day variants of this scheme. They are usually run in offshore banking centers, such as the Cayman Islands, to avoid regulation. Offshore funds are exempt from margin requirements that restrict trading on credit, and from uptick rules that limit short sales to assets that are rising in price. Hedge funds were originally set up to hedge the bets of investors, ensuring against currency or interest rate fluctuations, but they quickly became instruments for manipulation and control. Many of the largest hedge funds are run by former bank or investment bank dealers who have left with the blessings of their former employers. The bank's investment money is then placed with the hedge funds, which can operate in a more unregulated environment than the banks can themselves. By 2005, hedge funds were often responsible for over half the daily trading in the equity markets due to their huge size and the huge amounts of capital funding them. And we will continue next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.